Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program. The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools, and we're here every Saturday at 12 noon to defend and promote public education. Let's just remind you, that's education that's public in purpose and outcome. Above all, it's public in access. It's open to all children, teachers, employees, etc. And as well as that, we believe that it should be publicly owned and controlled, because it's the only one that can be publicly accountable. And for that reason, for all those reasons, we also believe that it's the only one that should be publicly funded. Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools are here every Saturday at 12 noon on the dot, because 3CR is really very, very efficient, particularly for a community radio, you know, probably much more efficient than the ABC. We take great pride in our expertise, and the Dogs director is very, very efficient indeed, aren't you, Dale? But we have some interesting material for you today. We have a press release 1046, which is to be on our website at www.adogs.info. And it's about where our politicians go to school and where they send their children. Not all of them are prepared to admit to where they send their children, but most of them are prepared to admit to where they went to school. And perhaps it might just explain why it is that state school people have such trouble persuading these politicians to give our children in our public systems enough money. Even the resource standard that was decided by Gonski 15 years ago, all the way back in 2010, we still haven't got there, even though there's a Labor government. So where did they go to school such that they are prepared to keep up this very unequal treatment in the funding wars of our education system? And where do they send their children? Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools, press release number 1046. Where did our politicians go to school and where do they send their children? Even though we have had a Labor government in power since 2022 and now have one with an increased majority, Australia still has one of the most unequal education systems in the OECD, with taxpayer funding, direct and indirect, favouring the wealthy and religious. The class of 2024. In 2024, research indicated that private school graduates were overrepresented in the nation's parliament, with data revealing more than half of independent and coalition MPs attended non-government schools. Findings from the research were presented by Christopher Harris and published in the Sydney Morning Herald, 15th of September 2024. The analysis was based on data on MPs' school backgrounds compiled by Think Tank Per Capita. Where no high school information was available, schooling information was subsequently obtained by the Sydney Morning Herald for most of the remaining MPs. Half of Labor MPs went to public schools, including Assistant Employment Minister Andrew Lee, who graduated from the selective James Roos. It was an easy place to be a nerd, he said. About 23% of Labor MPs in the 2024 Parliament were privately educated. Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles went to Geelong Grammar, Parramatta MP Andrew Charlton attended Knox, and Bennelong MP Jerome Laxall graduated from King's. Coalition Shadow Minister Angus Taylor also attended King's. Paul Fletcher went to Sydney Grammar, Andrew Hastie went to Scots, and Opposition Leader Peter Dutton went to St Paul's, a private school in Brisbane. About 30% of Coalition MPs went to private schools. However, that proportion rises to 39% for Shadow Ministers. It is well above the 20% of students nationally who currently attend independent schools. Independent MPs Zali Stegall went to Queenwood, Allegra Spender went to Asham, while Kylia Tink graduated from public school in Coonabrabran in the New South Wales Central West. When it came to Labor, public, Catholic and private school alumni reflected the current split of students in Australia's schools. About 60% of Labor MPs went to public school, compared to 57% of the current school-aged population. However, a disproportionate number of those who hold ministerial positions went to Catholic schools. Other MPs, such as Lou O'Brien, dropped out from Pittwater High early because he had to take on caring responsibilities for his mother, while Warren Entsch also left school early in the 1960s, despite dreaming of studying to be a vet someday at university. "I was the eldest of four children. There was no such thing as HECS," he said. Labor public school graduates include Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek, who went to Jenali Girls, and Lee at James Bruce. It was Lee's memory of his public school education, which is a testimony to the best that our public schools offer our country's children. Lee said he loved the intellectual environment and the enthusiasm that teachers and students brought to curious inquiry and shaped his future passions and interests. Assignments were handed back in order of the lowest scoring student to the highest. Staff would play maths games at lunchtime and recess in the staff room, and teachers were passionate about the subjects. Judith Anderson, she was my English teacher and left me with a lifelong love of Jane Austen, William Shakespeare and John Donne, he said. The new class of 2025. There's 27 new members of the Labor Party's 123-member caucus, as well as the more recent Greens defector Dorinda Cox and Tasmanian Senator Josh DeLega, who filled Anne Urquhart's spot after her shift to Braddon. A survey of new members and senator published by Karen Barlow in the Saturday paper of the 28th of June 2025 shows Labor's caucus has a left majority for the first time since national groupings were introduced. She also lists and details of their home ownership, education and previous careers. Those who answered the question on their own education and that of their children indicated that roughly half of the newcomers attended public and half private, mainly Catholic schools. However, more were sending their children to private as opposed to public schools, although some proudly owned their public school inheritance and current support. For example, Julianne Campbell, a lecturer at Morton. Previous job, lawyer representing workers in the manufacturing industry. First woman state secretary and campaign director of Labor in Queensland. Faction, left. Union, Australian Manufacturing Workers Union. Religion, uniting. School, Brisbane State High School. Are your children in public, private or independent school? I have a 2-year-old daughter, Margaret. How many houses do you own? 2. What got you into politics? When I was in high school, the Liberal government was making deep cuts to tertiary education and it just didn't seem fair. I knew I couldn't sit back and do nothing. So at 17, I started going to local branch meetings. I've always believed that if something's not right, you have to stand up and take action. What are the issues you would like to champion during the term? Everywhere I go, people are feeling cost of living pressure, health, housing and affordability. I'll be championing the practical solutions our community needs to strengthen Medicare, make housing more affordable and ease everyday costs like energy bills, student debt and childcare. Rowan Holzberger, electorate, Ford. Previous job, fitter and machinist. Faction, left. Union, AMWU. Religion, none. School, Williama High School, Broken Hill. Are your children in public, private or independent school? Last child graduated from a state school today. How many houses do you own? 1. What got you into politics? Real life experience working in farming, construction and owning a small business. Understanding the pressures facing local families and the need for investment in our growing area. What are the issues you would like to champion during the term? Infrastructure and housing. I spent nearly a decade advocating for major infrastructure projects like the M1 upgrade and the Coomera Connector, so people in the local suburbs can get home sooner. I'm a passionate advocate for the Albanese government's record investment in housing and for the plan to deliver a future made in Australia through investment in local manufacturing to create good, secure jobs for local workers. Anne Urquhart, electorate, Braddon. Previous job, Senator for Tasmania, Tasmanian State Secretary of the AMWU, and a factory worker. Faction, left. Union, the AMWU. Religion, not applicable. School, East Alverston Primary School, Alverston High School, and Devonport Technical College. Are your children in a public, private or independent school? My children are adults with children of their own. My children attended public schools, Alverstone Central Primary School, Alverstone High School and Don College. How many houses do you own? 1. What got you into politics? I have fought for working people all my life. Whether it was on the factory floor at Edgell Birdseye or organising for the AMWU, I knew that only Labor will protect the interests of working people. Well, it's possible that some may disagree with that sentiment. One way Labor could demonstrate this purported support of working people would be to fully fund all state schools and to do so immediately. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Andy. And you can see why it is that the Dogs are against any state aid, any of our taxpayers' money going to these private schools. We don't object to them existing if the wealthy want to buy their way out of meeting up with our children in the public schools. That's their problem, not ours, but they should be prepared to pay for it. But what is really quite shocking is not only that they win the funding stakes with direct aid, but in all sorts of indirect ways with taxation concessions, they also are way ahead. So Andy's got some very interesting material that Caitlin Cassidy and Henry Bellow of The Guardian have put together. But I believe that they would have got a lot of this information from Trevor Cobold from Save Our Schools up there in Canberra. But here is Andy again.
Thanks, Jean. Cruel joke. Tax concession drives donations to Australia's richest private schools and must stop, critics argue. 11 private schools each received more than $3 million from donors in 2023, topped by St Aloysius College in Sydney with $9.1 million. And this article was published in the Australian Guardian on Thursday, the 26th of June. The Albanese government has been urged to end an outrageous and cruel joke that incentivises donations to Australia's richest private schools in return for a tax deduction. But the peak body for independent schools says the criticism is overblown and that tax deductibility is essential to build campus infrastructure, with 95% of capital expenditure funded through parent contributions, fundraising, loans and philanthropy. Analysis of federal government data by the campaign group Save Our Schools has found out that more than $106 million was donated to 60 private schools in 2023. Some of these donations were considered tax-deductible gifts to charities, provided the money was designated for campus buildings. Some tax experts and analysts believe this concession, which is not extended to all charities and has been criticised by the Productivity Commission, has exacerbated inequality in the education system and added to the largesse of exclusive schools. The analysis revealed dozens of private schools received donation totaling more than $2 million in 2023, in addition to substantial revenue from investments and property portfolios and funding from government. It is a cruel joke that taxpayers who could never dream of sending their own schools to such a superbly well-resourced school are indirectly subsidising those that can, said Matthew Wade, a sociologist at La Trobe University who has studied the scheme for years. We should all be offended by witnessing something so manifestly unfair continue unabated. 11 private schools received more than $3 million from donors in 2023, topped by St Aloysius College in Kirribilli, which collected $9.1 million for bursaries and major building works from donation campaigns. Melbourne Grammar School received $5.9 million in donations, followed by the Scots College in Sydney, $4 million, and Xavier College in Melbourne, $3.9 million. Years of philanthropy has helped fund major building projects at these schools, including a sculpture walk, a rooftop playground with Sydney Harbour views, and expansive aquatic and sports centres. Professor Anne O'Connell, a tax expert at the University of Melbourne, said the tax concession for gifts to school building funds is outrageous. It dates from a time when it was difficult for the Commonwealth to make grants to non-government schools, O'Connell said. But Graham Catt, the chief executive of Independent Schools Australia, the peak body for the sector, said tax deductibility for school building donations was not just fair, it's essential. If anything, this is about private families picking up the bill where government support falls short, Catt said. The lion's share of government capital grants still flows to public schools. Philanthropy plays a vital role across the independent school sector, not just in funding buildings, but in enabling life-changing opportunities for students. Catt said donations to private schools have supported scholarships and bursaries that help families facing financial hardship, including Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students. Jason Ward, an analyst with the Centre for International Corporate Tax Accountability and Research, says it was ludicrous that donations to these elite private schools with family median incomes ranging between $225,000 and $495,000 should be tax deductible. On top of that, these well-endowed schools with high fees and their own income sources are getting more than $580 million in annual government funding, while the state public school systems are struggling with higher rates of teacher turnover and class sizes. But Kat said many of the buildings funded by donations, including science labs, libraries, outdoor learning areas, and multi-purpose halls, benefited the broader local community. The benefits of philanthropy extend well beyond the school gate, Kat said. David Crosby, the Chief Executive of the Community Council for Australia, CCA, said many small charities were unable to provide tax-deductible status to donors, despite providing services to the community that provide a clear public benefit. CCA believes there are many issues with the current deductive gift receipt system that need reform, and private school building funds would be part of the reform, Crosby said. Last year, the Albanese government declined to support the Productivity Commission's recommendation that school building funds no longer be tax deductible. The federal government was contacted for comment. Back to you, Jean.
Well, that's pretty interesting stuff. Thank you very much, Andy, for all the work you do for the dogs. But let's have a break.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
RCR is radical radio.
Through our on-air content and community structure, we promote real change for workers' rights, gender equality, environmental action, disability justice, and on racism and First Nations sovereignty.
Do you want to be part of real radical change?
We need you to subscribe. It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Call 03-9419-8377. That's 9419-8377. Or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the dogs because there's some even more interesting material coming up. There's nothing quite like private schools for crying poor. They're tremendous at crying poor, and they're really screaming their heads off because the state government wants them to pay taxes that in fact the state schools have to pay. Yes, they're really, the caterwauling is going up like no one's business. And The Age have a very interesting report about how the tax, the payroll tax, which the state schools have to pay and which the government just wants them to pay, like the state schools, they say that the tax is going to break them. So let's hear about it from The Age reporter, I think it is Noel Tal.
Thank you, Jean. This article by Noel Tal is titled, "This Tax Will Break Them. The Private Schools About to Be Slugged with Huge Bills." Three more Melbourne private schools will be hit with the state government's controversial new payroll tax next week, and another 10 will be paying the controversial charge within 3 years. Alphington Grammar, Deutsche Schule Melbourne in North Fitzroy, and Luther College in Croydon face new tax bills in the coming financial year of $966,000, $147,000, and $2.4 million, respectively. The tax threshold is not linked to inflation. All three schools will pay the state government more in payroll tax than they receive from it in education funding, with Luther College nearly $900,000 behind. Parents at Alpington Grammar and Deutsche Schule have already begun paying special levies on top of tuition fees to help soften the financial blow. The threshold for the tax, school income of $15,000 per student, is not linked to inflation or indexed, meaning that more and more schools will be caught by the tax each year until at least 2029, when a review of the charge is due. The three schools will join 58 private schools that already pay the tax. Private schools lobby group Independent Schools Victoria says mid-market institutions are now being forced to pay the charge, which the government argued was supposed to target only the state's wealthiest private schools. Among the schools set to be hit in the coming years, according to the analysis by the Independent Parliamentary Budget Office, is Hawthorne's Rossbourne Specialist School, and the state opposition warns that the Labor government should prepare for a fight over what the Liberals call taxation of the education of children with special needs. The government had to back down in the face of community and political backlash 2 years ago when the initial list of schools slated to pay the tax included the tiny Andale Specialist School in Kew with 22 students, alongside some of Australia's wealthiest and most prestigious schools such as Geelong Grammar and Scotch College. Opposition education spokesman Jess Wilson said, year after year, Labor's insidious school tax continues to make life harder for more students, families and school communities. Even specialist schools such as Rossbourne are in danger of being hit with this tax, denying students with learning difficulties the tailored education they need and deserve. Alpington Grammar Principal Vivian Nikau said on Thursday that families at her school were far from elite private school parents. "We're low to middle cost compared to other independent schools," Nikau said. "It's a small school that has a specialisation in catering for multicultural kids from mixed marriages and new families looking to give their kids an opportunity. They're aspirational families and buying an independent school education for the first time. This kind of tax will break them." Nikau said the school had formed a partnership ahead of the tax hike with financial services company EdStart, which offers deferred payment plans on school fees at commercial interest rates, and that every family with children at Alpington had signed up. Independent Schools Victoria Chief Executive Rachel Holthouse, who wants what she calls the fundamentally unfair tax scrapped altogether, said she's recently written to Education Minister Ben Carroll with several suggestions for indexing the threshold to protect mid to low cost schools from financial shock. But the government remained steadfast that there would be no review of the tax until a scheduled review in 2029, Holthouse said. Without indexation, the pace at which some of those small schools find themselves liable for the tax is faster, she said. Many schools that don't fit the profile of the expensive 150-year-old sandstone school are looking at the runway, and they're already on it for payroll tax. Carroll's office was contacted for comment. And this is what happens when schools are run as profit-making businesses as opposed to educational institutions. It's a bad business plan. Back to you, Jean.
Well, there's some very interesting figures, of course. Wesley College is kicking up a big stink because they're going to lose $2.1 million. Well, just imagine how many teachers they've got and how what they're paying them for that kind of money. And Caulfield Grammar is going to be losing about $1.3 million. Xavier College is only losing about $1.3 million. And Carey Baptist Grammar School is probably going to lose about $1.3 million too. Well, they are kicking up a stink when they in fact get tens of millions of dollars from our government. Scotch College, they're going to lose only $1.1 million. They can afford, of course, to build a big library like a castle in Scotland. $1.1 million, and they're screaming about that. Methodist Ladies College, the same. They're going to lose about $1 million. Lauriston Girls' School is only going to lose $947,500. Presbyterian Ladies College is only going to pay 766,700. They can't be paying their teachers as much as the others, I suppose. And Camberwell Grammar similarly, 701,300. So it's very interesting. The figures are very interesting indeed. How much they're being asked to pay. It's really chicken feed when you consider the tens of thousands they get from us, and sorry, the tens of millions they get from us, and not to mention the millions that they get in actual fees from the students themselves. Yes, so we do get a little bit sick and tired of these wealthy schools crying poor.
Mm. But, especially when, as you said earlier, these are taxes that public schools are expected to pay. State schools are expected to pay these taxes on not even getting the SRS, the Schooling Resource Standard, which is the bare minimum you need to run a school. And that was decided by, you know, a nonpartisan board, you know, who said, this is the bare minimum you need to run a school, and state schools do not even receive that from the government, while these wealthy schools are receiving up to 120% of the SRS. And the state schools are still managing to pay payroll tax on the shoestring that they're getting. But these schools, they can take the tax money, but they can't give it.
They don't cry poor, of course, when they're exhibiting their wares for the parents of wealthy children who have to pay anything up to $40,000 a year in fees. Now, you multiply that by a few hundred and this is chicken feed, isn't it?
Mm.
Anyway, we'll have a bit of a break, shall we?
Join me at your choir with Ubuntu Voices Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. on 3CR. Ubuntu is a Zulu word meaning I am here because you are. Ubuntu celebrates the positive contribution African Australians make to our communities in music, academia, the arts, and everything in between. Come with me on a journey. Ubuntu Voices, every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m.
None of us are free, one of us is chained, none of us are free.
Want to defend government schools? We are the DOGS, D-O-G-S, Defenders of Government Schools. Every week on the DOGS program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school. If you're a parent, or if you're a kid, or if you're involved in the school in any way whatsoever, and you love your state school, give 3CR a call. We want to hear about these schools that we're defending. Brunswick Secondary
State schools are great.
Harkaway Primary School.
Sunshine North Primary
School. They're really concerned about the welfare of the kids and their growth as people as well as learning.
You put on plays, you've got enrichment, you've got physical education, visual arts, languages, all that. In fact, is there a cooking?
Actually, an embracing of kids from disadvantaged backgrounds and with additional needs.
More than half of your kids are from some of the poorest families in Australia.
Yeah, definitely. That's the community and that's who we're servicing and that's who we welcome into the school.
Outdoor play is linked to healthier and happier children. This in turn leads to better grades.
In the weekly assemblies and stuff, they have a little thing, you've been caught being good, and they have a value of the week each week, and so it's not just words, it is actually.
So what do the teachers do when it's a building site? Yeah, they kick themselves out of their own staff room and turn it into a classroom.
Just a really nice culture and an emphasis on social skill building as well as learning. Quite a range of intellectual ability and kids with mental health diagnoses. Refugee kids who have not been in the country very long don't necessarily start off with a
positive
great
relationships with each other, with teachers and with the community.
And they run a breakfast club. There's a recognition that some kids don't get breakfast and so there's food on.
If you are involved in a state school and it's a great school, we'd love to hear from you so we can talk about it and tell the world.
Leave a message for the DOGS at 3CR on 94198377.
State schools are great schools.
Great state schools.
For 3 years,
those teachers have had their qualifications, their pay, their pensions and their working conditions attacked relentlessly by this government.
I'm the proud product of a government-funded primary school education and of a government-funded secondary school education.
Australia is one of the richest and luckiest countries in the world, and there's no reason whatsoever why we can't have the very best public schools in the world.
It's still not good enough that kids with disability miss out.
Our education is not for profit. Our education is not for profit.
You're listening to The Dogs, the defence of government schools on 3CR.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program because now we're going overseas to Canada and the United States with Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. We're going to start today in Canada, where there's an interesting change proposed to remove the charitable status for religious groups. This would affect education because if they're no longer a charity, then they would have to pay tax. So this article came from Sask Today, which I assume is Saskatoon in the north of Canada, from June 18th. It's written by the Sask Today staff. So they haven't actually named the author, probably because of the content. It's called Proposed Charitable Status Changes Spark Debate. And it's from the 18th of June 2025. Yorkton. A recent parliamentary report has ignited debate over charitable status regulations in Canada, with faith-based and pro-life organisations at the centre of the discussion. The Standing Committee on Finance's pre-budget consultations in advance of the 2025 budget report includes two recommendations that have drawn criticism from religious and pro-life groups. Recommendation 429 calls for the government to no longer provide charitable status to anti-abortion organisations. Recommendation 430 urges amendments to the Income Tax Act that would remove the privileged status of advancement of religion as a charitable purpose. Under current federal guidelines, advancement of religion qualifies as a charitable purpose if it involves theistic worship and the promotion of spiritual teachings, including the maintenance of religious traditions, institutions and outreach programs. These charities are eligible for tax exemptions and other benefits. Opponents of the recommendations argue that faith-based charities contribute significantly to Canadian society beyond religious observance, with programs that include food banks, mental health initiatives and newcomer support. Yorkton Melville Conservative MP Cathy Wagentle has sponsored an electronic petition opposing the proposals. The House of Commons e-petition 6586 calls on the government to reject the Finance Committee's recommendations. These groups contribute immensely to Canadian society, says Wagentle in a release dated June 18th. For the Liberals, that's the new government, or the Liberal government in over there, which is the left-wing government, is in charge, is my editorial. For the Liberals to target their charitable status simply because it does not agree with their faith traditions will effectively terminate their important work, including food banks, mental health outreach, support for seniors, youth, families and newcomers, added Wagentle in the release. The petition also references concerns about religious freedom, protected under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Freedom of religion or belief is a fundamental right protected by the Charter, says Wagentle. Canadians of all beliefs turn to faith-based charity daily as a source of hope, belonging and compassion. This important work for the common good must be allowed to continue. The Liberal Party has previously signalled support for similar measures in its election platforms in both 2021 and 2025. And that petition is now open in the House of Commons there. So, yeah, there's a serious chance that they may remove the charitable status of churches and religious groups and pro-life groups in Canada, which is a serious move to the secular, which the Dogs would approve of because we believe in separation of church and state entirely. Now, I'm going to go to an article appeared on 1st of July 2025. It's on the Diana Ravitch blog, and it's about Glenn Sachs, who's a veteran social studies teacher in Los Angeles Public High School. Many of the students he teaches are immigrants. He describes here what he has learned about them, and he wrote this originally in the Huffington Post. The article is titled, Glenn Sachs, I Teach Immigrant Kids from in an LA High School. Here's the truth. So, as you know, this is just my editorial. As you know, LA has been the focus of the Trump regime's ICE raids, taking undocumented migrants and putting them in detention centres or deporting them to other countries. And, in fact, they're building new internment camps for them. The new one is the Alligator Alcatraz down in Florida, but they're building new prisons for undocumented people. So anyway, this is a quote he starts with from Donald Trump. If they spit, we will hit, and I promise you they will be hit harder than they've ever been hit before. Such disrespect will not be tolerated. Quote by Donald Trump. And the article begins. President Trump says he's defending Los Angeles from a foreign invasion, but the only invasion we see is the one being led by Trump. Roughly a quarter of all students in the Los Angeles Unified School District are undocumented. The student body at the high school where I teach consists almost entirely of immigrants, many of them undocumented, and the children of immigrants, many of whose parents and family members are undocumented. This week, we held our graduation ceremony under the spectre of Trump's campaign against our city. Outside, school police patrolled to guard against potential immigration and customs enforcement raids. Amidst rumours of various actions, LAUSD decided that some school graduations would be broadcast on Zoom. For many immigrant parents, graduation day is the culmination of decades of hard work and sacrifice, and many braved the threat of an ICE raid and came to our campus anyway. Others, perhaps wisely, decided to watch from home. They deserve better. Trump's Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, calls us a city of criminals, and many Americans are cheering on the Trump administration and vilifying immigrants. What we see in LAUSD is an often heroic generation of immigrant parents working hard to provide for their children here while also sending remittance money to their families in their native countries. We see students who usually are a pleasure to teach and parents who are grateful for teachers' efforts. Watching the students at the graduation ceremony, I saw so many who have had to overcome so much, like the student in my AP US government class who from age 12 worked weekends for his family business, but made it into UCLA and earned a scholarship. There's a girl who had faced homelessness this year, the boy with learning issues who powered through my AP class via an obsessive effort that his friends would kid him about, but which he committed to anyway. He got an A, which some of the students ribbing him did not. Many students have harrowing, horrific stories of how they got into the US, stories you can only learn usually by coaxing it out of them. There's the student who grew up in an apartment complex in San Salvador, where once girls reached a certain age, they were obligated to become the girlfriend of a member of whatever gang controlled that area. When she was 14, they came for her, but she was ready. She shot a gang member before slipping out of the country, going all the way up through Guatemala and Mexico, desperate to find her father in Los Angeles. As she told me this story at parent conference night, tears welled up in her father's eyes. It's also touching to watch their loving, long-running argument. He wants her to manage and eventually take over the small business he'd built, and she wants to become an artist instead. To this day, she does not know whether the gang member she shot lived or died. At the graduation ceremony, our principal asks all those who will be joining the armed forces to stand up to be recognised. These students are a windfall for the US military. I teach seniors, and in an average class, three or four of my students join the military, most often with the Marines, either right out of high school or within a couple of years. Were these bright, hard-working young people born into different circumstances, they would have gone to college. Instead, they often feel compelled to join the military for the economic opportunity, the so-called economic draft. Some also enlist because it helps them gain citizenship and or helps family members adjust their immigration status. A couple of years ago, an accomplished student told me he was joining the Marines instead of going to college. I was a little surprised and asked him why, and he replied, because it's the best way to fix my parents' papers. Immigrants are the backbone of many of our industries, including construction and home building, restaurants, hospitality and agriculture. They are an indispensable part of the senior care industry, particularly in assisted living and in-home care. Of the couple dozen people who cared for my ailing parents during a decade of navigating them through various faculties, I can't remember one who was not an immigrant. There is something especially disturbing about disparaging the people who care for us when we're old, sick, and at our most vulnerable. Immigrants are woven into the fabric of our economy and our society. They are our neighbours, our co-workers, our friends, and an integral part of our community. The average person in Los Angeles interacts with them continually in myriad ways and without a thought to their immigration status. Immigrants are also maligned for allegedly leeching off public benefits without paying taxes to finance them. This week, conservative commentator Matt Walsh called to ban all third world immigration, whether it's legal or illegal, explaining, "We cannot be the world's soup kitchen anymore." One can't teach a US government and politics class in Los Angeles without detailing the phenomenon of taxpayers blaming immigrants for the cost of Medicaid, food stamps and other social programs. My students are hurt when they come to understand that many Americans look at their parents, who they've watched sacrifice so much for them, as takers. Nor is it true. Californians pay America's highest state sales tax. It is particularly egregious in Los Angeles, where between this and the local surcharge, we pay 9.75%. As I teach my economics students, this is a regressive tax where LAUSD students and their parents must pay the same tax rate on everything they buy as billionaires do. Moreover, most immigrants are renters and they informally pay property taxes through their rent. California ranks the seventh highest in the nation in average property taxes paid. Our state government estimates that immigrants pay over $50 billion in state and local taxes and over $80 billion more in federal taxes. Add this to the enormous value of their labour, and America is getting a bargain. Part of what is driving the current protests is the sense that once somebody is taken by ICE, their families won't know their fate. Where will they be sent? Will they get due process? Will they end up in a Salvadoran mega prison, where even if it's ordered that they be returned home, the president may pretend he can't get them back? Is it fitting that the flashpoint for much of the protests has been the Federal Metropolitan Detention Center downtown? We also question the point of all this, particularly since the Trump administration can't seem to get its story straight as to why ICE is even here. Trump's border czar, Tom Horman, says the raids are about enforcing laws against hiring undocumented workers and threatens more worksite enforcement than you've ever seen in the history of this nation. By contrast, Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin, citing murderers, pedophiles and drug traffickers, says the purpose of the raids is to arrest criminal illegal aliens. And now, having provoked protests, the Trump administration uses them as a justification for escalating his measures against Los Angeles. Amid this, our graduating students struggle to focus on their goals. One Salvadorian student who came to this country less than 4 years ago, knowing little English, managed the impressive feat of getting an A in my AP class. He'd sometimes come before school to ask questions or seek help passing through the latest immigration document he'd received. Usually, whatever document I read over did not provide him much encouragement. He earned his admission to a University of California school where he'll be studying biomedical engineering. Perhaps one day he'll help develop a medicine that will benefit some of the people who don't want him here. When we said goodbye after the graduation ceremony, I didn't know what to say beyond what I've often told him in the past. Just keep your head down and keep marching forward. I will, he replied. That's the end of the article. It's indeed strange times at the moment in the States, and our hearts go out to the people suffering under the current regime. With that, I'm going to head you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and hope you have a really nice weekend. Cheerio.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff. Now Andy's going to take us over to the UK.
Thanks, Jean. If you went to state school, do you ever feel British life is rigged against you? Welcome to the 93% Club. And this was published in the UK Guardian on the 19th of June and written by Alistair Campbell. the civil service, judiciary and media are still dominated by the privately educated 7%. Lasting change is not a pipe dream, but it's up to us. For the first time in our history, we have a cabinet made up entirely of people who went to state schools. Several, including Prime Minister Keir Starmer, come from working class backgrounds. Some, such as Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner, were raised in conditions of poverty that feel as if they ought to belong to another age. So far, so good. What better signs could one ask for to show that Britain is a meritocracy, social mobility is real, and anyone can rise to the top, provided they have talent, commitment, and determination. And yet, it might be that in some ways these are exceptions that prove a rule, the rule being that for all the changes made down the years, a private education continues to give disproportionate advantage to those, currently 7%, who use it. Yes, we have a state-educated cabinet and more state school MPs than ever. Yet, more broadly throughout the establishment, when looking at senior positions across Whitehall, the judiciary, law, media and finance, the 7% club continues to hold a disproportionate presence and therefore to exercise disproportionate cultural and political power. That 7% figure is what gave rise to the 93% club, the UK's network for state-educated people. Its latest report, the Big State School Survey, merits careful reading by anyone who thinks that because we have the most working class cabinet of our lifetime, the old class divides are gone and the dream of genuine social mobility has been delivered. The survey suggests that though state educated students may be the majority by far, it is the 93% who have to fit in with the attitudes and actions of the 7% rather than the other way around. The overwhelming sense of the research is that talk of class continues to be brushed aside as impolite conversation, yet it continues to determine who will thrive, who will falter, and who is forced to adopt a new cultural identity just to get into the room. What the survey does is show the emotional cost of having to leave parts of your identity and community behind to thrive. It brings a darker side of social mobility into the light. The journey starts at university. For many, the culture shock is instant. Nearly three quarters of all state school students report experiencing it. That figure rises to 91% among those from working class backgrounds, and 94% of students believe that university culture naturally caters to the wealthy. The little things add up. Three in four students say they miss out on formals and dinners, a component of life at universities such as Oxford and Cambridge. Many say they can't afford to join sports teams or take part in extracurricular activities. The result is not just feeling out of place, but feeling like the place was never meant for you, despite your having worked hard to get there. The divide doesn't end with a degree. In fact, it deepens. 93% of working class professionals say their background clashes with workplace culture. Many end up straddling two worlds, the one they came from and the one they now operate in, feeling that they don't fully belong to either. To fit in, people say they start to change. Accent, clothes, hobbies, even what they eat and drink. These are not small cosmetic tweaks. They're survival tactics in environments that reward polish over potential. And while a lot of this happens quietly, with a smile, a nod, a stiff upper lip mentality, the impact is loud and lasting. 61% of respondents said they had to leave their community behind to progress. Nearly half said their friendships changed. Some grew distant from their families. This is not social mobility, it's a social trade-off. I've long been a fan of the 93% Club, not least because of its 29-year-old founder, Sophie Pender, knows firsthand what it means to come from nothing and make it in the city with few tools or support at her disposal. And what's refreshing about what her organisation is doing is that it's not accepting the status quo or burning it down. Instead, it is retooling the idea of an old boys network to serve state school graduates. An old boys and old girls network for the many, not the few, you might say. The question now is, do we want a country where success still depends on knowing the right people, sounding the right way, and fitting into the right mould, or do we want one where talent is prized and diversity of thought guaranteed? Real social mobility shouldn't come at the cost of your character. It shouldn't mean sanding down your accent, hiding where you're from, or second-guessing how you dress, speak, or behave. It should mean being able to walk into any room and be taken seriously. A cabinet that reflects that reality is a start, but it can't be the end goal. If we want lasting change, we need more than symbolism. We need infrastructure. A nationwide state school alumni network that offers the kind of cultural capital, career support and peer sponsorship long taken for granted by the privately educated. A network that not only helps people navigate elite spaces, but also mobilises them to rework the cultures within them. The 93% Club has already made significant strides in creating this infrastructure, but it still has work to do. They're asking others to join in, to share their time, open doors, and help rewire the systems that still quietly reward one kind of background over another. It's not a pipe dream. It's a proven model that private schools have used for centuries. It's high time we repurposed it to build a country where people can succeed by not leaving their identity at the door, but by walking through it the way they are. Back to you, Jean.
Well, the good time of our program has come, the nice time, and we want to tell you about our great state school. And we're going down to Tasmania because at the very start, you might remember, we were talking about some of our members of parliament who actually did go to state schools, and I think it was the final one, Ms. Urquhart, down there in Tasmania, who went to this school, and Andy's going to tell us about it.
Every week on the Dogs program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Ulverston Primary School. Now, Ulverston is a town on the northern coast of Tasmania, on the mouth of the River Leven, about 21 kilometres west of Davenport. The school was established in 1870 and has a tradition of providing quality state-funded education for students in years K to 6 from the surrounding community. At Ulverston Primary School, we pride ourselves on being student-centred. We have high expectations for our staff and students. At UPS, our aim is to provide a safe and supportive learning environment where all students are able to reach for the stars and achieve their best. We encourage our families to work in partnership with us to provide an environment where we work together to inspire and engage all learners to learn more every day. We believe that relationships matter, and our staff strive to develop productive relationships with our students. We set high expectations for students to take pride in wearing their school uniform and to care for our school environment. At Ulverston Primary School, we offer the Australian Curriculum Prep to Year 6 and the Early Years Framework Birth to Year 2, delivered through a range of classroom specialist programs and authentic learning environments, such as our Stephanie Alexander Kitchen Garden. Our Launching into Learning program welcomes families with children birth to 4 to work with us in partnership to develop confident, involved learners and effective communicators. We offer students the opportunity to participate in specialist lessons such as music, STEAM, and physical education. We provide an innovative and challenging learning environment where students are well equipped to flourish and to meet future academic and life challenges. At Ulverston Primary, our goal is to ensure that high-quality teaching and learning is occurring in every classroom, and we're always striving towards our vision, together today for tomorrow. So we have a student population of 365, and the school ICSEA value is 949, below the average of 1,000. What this means is that 11% of students have parents in the top 25% of Australian incomes, 16% in the next quartile, 28% of students with parents below average income in that third quartile, and 46% of students with parents earning in the lowest 25% of Australian incomes. The school has 21% Indigenous students, and 3% speak a language other than English. The Australian Government recurrent funding is $1.35 million, and from the Tasmanian Government, just over $5 million. This works out per student with other income added at $18,297. Now looking at the funding, the Australian government recurrent funding is $1.355 million and the funding from the state government is $5.07 million. Fees, charges and parent contributions add another $61,000 and another $21,000 from private sources. And this comes to $18,297 per student. Capital expenditure from the state government, $2.36 million over the last 3 years. And back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Ulverston Secondary College. And that time has come for us to say goodbye. So I'd like to remind you about our website at www.adogs.info. And to also thank all of those who were generous to the dogs in the 3CR Radiothon. And we might be thanking you personally in coming weeks, but it remains for me to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and of course, Andy, her offsider, and Jeff. And so thank you so much for this program. If you want to hear previous programs, you can go to the 3CR website and look at our podcasts. But from us all here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.